It's great to be with you this morning. Lynn and I had the opportunity this past week to travel together to Asheville, North Carolina. And we were at the Billy Graham Training Center, which is also called The Cove. And we were there specifically for a ministry couples conference. This was a conference that was specifically designed for pastors and their spouses to come and have the opportunity to be in a great environment, but also to address issues that ministry couples have to deal with, perhaps uniquely, and just to work on our marriage. And we had a great time. We are so grateful for a church and for a board of elders that views our marriage as important enough that they would send us back there to do that. And so we're just grateful. And, you know, I want to just say to you, I know everybody here is not married, but for those of you that are, how important it is that every once in a while you intentionally get away and specifically work on your marriage relationship. Because marriage is an awesome gift of God. It brings great blessing and enjoyment into our life. But let's face it, it's also a lot of work. And that's true for all of us. And so I just encourage you to do that if you have the opportunity to get away as a couple and to find some way to kind of feed your marriage. And a lot of that, too, to be honest, we were fed by God's word, as Chip Ingram taught us about marriage. And it was just a great, great time together. Well, this morning, we're continuing our study in the book of Deuteronomy. If you have a Bible, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. If not, that's fine. We'll have the words up on the screen. You will remember that this book of Deuteronomy contains a number of sermons which Moses preached to the people of Israel as they were getting ready to enter the promised land. And today we come to chapter 7, where Moses deals with what I believe is an extremely relevant and challenging subject for us today. It's the issue of how the Israelites were to handle the Canaanite people who were already in the land. Now, let me give you a little history in case you're not aware of this. Many years earlier, God had called Abraham to leave his country and go to this new promised land. God said to Abraham, I will give you that land, and not just to you, but to your descendants, and I'm going to make you a great nation. And remember that Abraham obeyed God, and he and Sarah went and lived in that land for many years. They raised their son Isaac there, and Isaac raised his two sons, Jacob and Esau, there as well. And then you might remember that there was a famine that really spread throughout the Middle East. And Jacob's sons, who were called the sons of Israel, 12 of them, moved to Egypt in order to survive. And the people of Israel were in Egypt for 400 years. Eventually, they became so numerous that the Egyptian pharaohs saw them as a threat and forced them into slavery. But then you write, remember that God heard the cries of his people, and God delivered them with a mighty hand in this great event we call the Exodus. And his plan all along was to bring them back to that land that he had promised to Abraham and his descendants. And now, as Moses speaks to them, they're ready to go in and take possession of the land. But there was one significant problem. There were all these different tribes of people who for the last 400 years had come in and settled in the promised land. Together, these people are called the Canaanites. And they had a religion that involved idol worship. And as part of their religion, they had evil, dark practices like ritual prostitution and child sacrifice, not to mention sorcery and witchcraft and all these kinds of things. And so the big question for the Israelites was, what do we do with these people? How do we handle them? I mean, these folks are certainly not going to throw a welcome home party for us as we just traipse in there and take over. So what do? Should we befriend them? Should we avoid them? Should we just try to blend in with them? What should we do? And this, of course, is an issue that we today, in the 21st century, have to deal with every day of our lives. As followers of Christ, we know that we have been sent into the world. But we also know that the world system, if you will, is at odds with what we believe and what we hold dear. As a matter of fact, Scripture says the world is in the grip of someone other than God. Did you know that? The Apostle John wrote about this. John said, "We know that we are of God, and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one." That's a strong statement. As a result, the world is now driven by a way of thinking about life, a way of looking at life that is antithetical to the things that God says are true and to the things that God values. Listen again to the Apostle John. He says, "All that is in the world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is of the world." And this proud, greedy, lustful spirit, we have to understand, is the essence of idolatry. Paul wrote about this. He wrote about immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed. And then look what he says. What does all that amount to? It amounts to idolatry. So even today, we are facing the same thing the Israelites faced as they entered the land. And so the question today is, how do we handle that? How do we, as God's people today, relate to the world? And the instructions that God gave to the sons of Israel were very clear. Look what he says in verses 1 through 5. Once again, chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. "When the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. But thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their Asherim and burn their graven images with fire." So it's pretty clear. God simply says, listen, you're going into this land, and I want you to know that I am going to deliver these people before you. But you have to do something too. You have to be separate for them, and you have to destroy them. Now, we have to deal with that. This is going to bother some of us. How could God encourage such violence? How could God encourage the destruction of women and children? But before you react to this, I want to be sure that we really understand exactly what Moses is saying. Because I believe the translation we have here very well may be a bit misleading. Put your scholar hat on just for a second, okay? I won't bore you too long with details. But several very fine scholars point out that rather than translating this as a command to destroy the Canaanites, rather, this is an absolute and irrevocable renouncing of things or persons, a refusal to take any gain or profit from them. So in obedience to this command, things or persons could be renounced without being destroyed. And I have to tell you that this is consistent with what Moses says right here about not making treaties with them or not intermarrying with them. Why would you worry about intermarrying with the people if you destroyed them? It doesn't make sense. And this is also consistent with what the Israelites actually did when they got into the land. all but two of the battles fought were defensive battles. In other words, the Canaanites attacked them. And only four cities were actually destroyed in the conquest. You can read all about that in the books of Joshua and Judges. I might add, though, that could it be true that some cultures are so evil and so depraved that they need to be completely destroyed? Like a fungus, if you even allow the smallest remnant to remain, it will eventually overtake you. But I believe the idea here is that they were to stay separate from the people around them. They were to renounce their way of life, and this would extend to every arena of life. So politically, make no treaties, make no covenants with them. Socially, do not intermarry with them. And religiously, tear down their altars, tear down their idols. And so we have to ask the question, what does this mean for you and I? Now we know that God has sent us into the world as it is. We know that God has called us to reach the lost. We know that Jesus himself was criticized for being a friend of sinners. And nevertheless, we also know that God has called us to be different and, in a sense, to be separate from the world. And this involves our behavior, but even more so, it involves the things that inform our behavior, what we call our values. So let me ask you, what does the world value? What does the world system value? Well, we know it values things. It values possessions, doesn't it? That's huge. It also values appearance, having the right clothes, the right image, looking good. We also know it values pleasure, having fun, having a good time, grabbing all the gusto you can grab in life. It also involves success and power, getting on top and staying there. The world values performance, good grades, good scores, good schools, good numbers. Now, none of these things necessarily are wrong in and of themselves. But as we've said before, the world takes these things, some of which are good things, and makes them into what? Ultimate things. And that's where the problem is. So people of the world don't just thank God for these things and enjoy these things, but people of the world live for these things, are defined by these things. Their entire life is based and rooted and founded on these things. So I want to be really honest with you today about something. I don't see believers in America at this time living all that differently than the people around us. I want you to know that. I don't see us living all that differently from the people around us. I mean, and this is not true of all of you, but it's true of some of you. We come in here and we get our God fix once a week. And we feel good. We pat ourselves on the back. You know, I went to church. That's a good thing. And it is a good thing. And we kind of leave and we feel good. And we had a good experience. And the music made us feel happy and all ooey gooey inside. And then we go home and we live exactly like everybody else. And something is wrong with that. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." And last time I looked, a light stands out, right? A light is different. A light draws you to it. And I'm not sure I see that happening. We're called to value things the world does not value. So what do we value? We value servanthood, for one. Not grabbing power, not grabbing fame, not grabbing those things, but giving it away. We're called to value purity as well. We believe sex is such an awesome, wonderful gift of God to be enjoyed, that it is to be protected and enjoyed within the lifelong commitment of a married relationship. And yes, that will require great discipline and great sacrifice for single people, as well as lifelong fidelity for married people. We're called to value character, the inner person, over appearance. We're called to value compassion and caring over accumulating more and more stuff. And I just wonder, how would this place be different if we all lived our life in that way? Do you think we'd stand out more? I think we would. I've been thinking about areas that this applies to, and obviously what comes to mind is what's been happening lately in our economy. When it comes to our savings, our retirement accounts, if we have them, and I know not everybody does, but if you're a homeowner, when you think about the value of your homes, it's been a pretty rough few weeks, hasn't it? And I know a lot of people that are in a place right now where you were making plans for your own retirement, and you're finding yourself right now in a position where you're going to have to work 3, 4, 5 more years than you ever thought you'd have to work, and that's tough. And there are a lot of people in that place. And have you noticed? People are really worried. People are really panicked. I feel the Lord just showed me that this week as I had conversations with people in Asheville and in California. And people are really terrified about this whole thing. But as believers, shouldn't our response be different? How can we be salt and light in this world if we react the same way as everybody else? I mean, it's hard for us. We're not supposed to like this necessarily. But here's the deal. If our treasure isn't here, but there, why panic? If our security is not here, but there, then why panic? What a great time. I'm so glad Alan prayed about it. What a great time for us as God's people to shine the light that says, our security is with God. Our riches are in heaven. That's what matters. That's what matters. So we don't trust the economy. We don't trust even the government as much as we might love this country. And many of us do. We don't trust our banks. We trust in God. So that's one of the ways that we represent God's values to a world that has a different set of values. I thought about this as it relates to another area of our life. How about as it relates to just the media and how we handle the media, how we interact with the media, computers, movies, how about television? I've been told this last week that the average American family watches 7 hours of television a day. 7 hours. 26% of children under 2 have a television in their own bedroom. The average American child sees 40,000 commercials a year. Advertisers spend $15 billion a year telling them what's hot. Nearly 2 out of 3 TV programs contain violence, an average of about 6 acts of violence per hour. There are more than twice as many violent incidents in children's programming than in other types of programming. Sexual content appears in 64% of all TV programs, with an average of 4.4 sex scenes per hour. And what do we do? What do we do as God's people? Well, we send our kids to Sunday school once a week for an hour, and we hope for the best. That's what we do so often. So how are your kids going to learn, but also internalize kingdom values when that's all we do? I mean, do you really want your kids learning sex education from Grey's Anatomy? I don't think so. It's in arenas like this that our values have to translate into hard decisions, hard choices. So what do? Well, at times, we turn the television off. We monitor very closely what our kids watch and what we watch. I have to tell you, I'm not one of those guys that says you ought to throw your TV out. I don't necessarily think that. But if you can't control it, then that might be the best option. Remember what Jesus said? He said, if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. That's what he said. That's how important this battle is. So I want you to know, make no mistake, we're in a fight. And to win this fight, we're going to have to be ruthless with everything around us. Because everything's going to oppose it. If you live this way, I guarantee you will feel like you're walking upstream against a very strong current that's pulling you in the other direction. That's why the Christian life is described as a fight. And if you are really in this fight, you will feel the pressure. It's interesting, though, because Moses did not just leave it there. Moses actually is going to go on and he's going to tell us why. He's going to give us the why. So oftentimes, parents, your child comes to you, you tell them to do something, they ask why, and what do you say? Because I told you. I know, I've done it. I'm the boss. I give the orders. You listen. Now, so we come to God. We say, okay, God, I hear what you're saying, but why? What does God say? He doesn't say, because I told you. God gives a much more compelling reason for this. And it's found in verse 6. Look at verse 6. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Do you see the reason? The reason is, simply put, that you are a holy people to the Lord your God. Notice Moses says they are not to live this way in order to be holy. That's not how it works. He says you are holy. And because you're holy, you are to live this way. It's a very big difference. Very big difference in your motivation. Very big difference in how you think. So don't miss that. And they are holy, or set apart, as the word means, by virtue of the fact that God has chosen them as his own possession. And the idea here is that they are God's treasure, God's inheritance. He has set them apart. He has set his affection on them. He has said, you are mine. And because you're mine, you are to live a certain way. You are to hear my voice. You're to live like people who belong to me. That's the reason. When our kids were young, or younger, we decided as a family that we wanted a second dog. Don't ask me why. Well, I'll tell you why. We already had one dog. And she was an older golden retriever, a rather large dog, as you know goldens are. So we had Samantha. We loved Samantha. She was getting on in years. We decided we wanted to get a younger dog. And we thought that that would help Samantha stay young. So we decided to get a younger dog, but we decided, you know what, we want a small younger dog. We want a little dog because we can't handle two big dogs, so let's get a little dog. So we started doing a bunch of research as a family. We got the dog books, and you know how you do that. And we decided, okay, here's what we want. We want a Karen Terrier. Now, I don't know if you know what a Karen Terrier is, but think Toto in Wizard of Oz. You know, that very annoying, yappy little dog. That's a Karen Terrier. So we found, finally, we couldn't find a breeder in the Bay Area. And finally we found this lady who had a litter. And she breeded these things out in East Sacramento, almost to Auburn. So we said, great. We called her up. We made an appointment. We got into the minivan one Saturday. All the kids were there, and we drove out to East Sacramento, about a 2.5-hour drive. Got to her house, walked in the door, and we discovered she only had two dogs left, little tiny things, little just, gosh, mushroom size, man, little guys, only two left. Now, you need to know that, you know, I'm one of those guys, I like to be prepared. And so I'd read all the books, you know, how do you select a puppy? Right? You know the key thing? You shake the key in their nose, and if they don't like it, oh, don't get that dog. But the minute we walked in that door, and I've got three little kids, my kids and my wife and the whole deal, and we're looking, the minute we walked in, saw the two dogs, they knew Mitch would be our dog. They knew which dog. That's our dog. That's Mitch. That's the one we want to take home. So, what do? We did all the things you're supposed to do. We paid her. You know, we put the dog in the doggy carrier. We brought him home. We paid for his shots. We house trained him. We fed them the right food. We took them out for walks. And of course, because we did all that, because we had selected Mitch as our dog, because we had invested all of that into Mitch, we expected Mitch to act like our dog and not somebody else's. That's a reasonable thing. So we expected him to bark at other people, not at us. When we called Mitch, we expected him to come to us and not run to the neighbor's house. These are very reasonable requests because of what we had done. We chose him. We paid for him. We trained him. You see, that is what God is saying. God is saying, listen, I chose you to be my people. I paid for you. I redeemed you. I fed you in the wilderness. And I've trained you. Now don't go running off to some other voice, to some other God. Did you know that the New Testament tells us the same thing is true of us who trust in Jesus? Did you know that? Jesus himself said, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." Now, somewhere along the lines, we chose him. But what we need to understand is that he made the first move. That's what he says. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4, Paul says, "He chose us in him before the foundation of the world." What a mind blower. Did you know that before you even existed, God knew you? And he didn't just know you, but he chose you? Peter could use even the same language that Moses uses here in verse 6. And Peter says to the people of God, he says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession." And because of that, because we're chosen, because we're holy, we run to his voice and not someone else's. We live according to his values, not the world's. I love how Paul puts it to the Colossians. He says, "And so as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience." You see, that's living in a way that's radically different from the world around us. Why? Not in order to be holy. Because you are holy. Because you are beloved. Because you've been chosen of God. Now, I'm sure that for many of us, this raises some questions, some difficult questions. There are some problems with this. And it's interesting because as this chapter 7 unfolds, and we can't look at every detail of it, but as it unfolds, Moses is going to deal with two practical problems that the Israelites would have to deal with as they confronted this whole thing in the promised land. And we have to deal with these things too as we try to work these issues out. So the first problem is pride. It's pride. When you hear that you've been chosen by God, why not think, well, God must have pretty good taste. I mean, there must be something really cool about me. Something really special. Something just that just kind of drew God to me, you know? Something really wonderful about me, something really attractive. Why else would God choose me and not this other guy? That's the problem of pride. And Moses addresses this in verses 7 and 8. Look what he says. He says, "The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any of these peoples. For you are the fewest of all peoples. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Now Moses hits this pride problem right on the head. In essence, what Moses asks here is he asks the question, why did the Lord love you? Why did the Lord choose you, Israel? Was it because he looked around and he sized you up and he compared you with everybody else and he said, wow, I really want these Israelites. They are a fine people. They are the pick of the litter. No. What's the answer he gives here? Why did the Lord love you? He loved you because he loved you. That's the answer. He loved you because he loved you. He loved you and he keeps loving you because he's a God who makes promises and he's a God who keeps his promises. And that's the only reason we ever get for why the Lord loved us and chose us. Why does he love me? Is it something wonderful about me? No way. He loves me because he loves me. You see, the reason is found not in me. The reason is found in him. When we understand that, I think it creates certain attitudes in us. One of the things it creates in us is deep humility. We no longer can look at other people, any other people, and say, boy, we sure are better than them. You know, God chose us. And you know, I have to tell you, this is one of the problems we have today with Christians, is that we act like that. We look at the world and we judge them and we point the finger at them and we act like we know it all and we're basically arrogant and self-righteous. And the world looks at that and nobody likes that. The fact of the matter is, if there is any reason at all that the Bible gives for why God loved us, why God chose us, it is not because we're better. It's because we're worse. It's not because we're bigger. It's because we're fewer. Listen to what Paul said to a proud congregation called the Corinthians. He said, "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things that are strong, and the base things of the world, and the despised God has chosen the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are, that no man should boast before God." In other words, he chose you and he chose me because we would be perfect specimens to show off his mercy and grace to helpless sinners. That's why he did it. If I really go back and I think about when we chose Mitch, and I think about what drew us to Mitch, you know what it was? He was the runt of the litter. That's what it was. He wasn't the biggest. He was the smallest. And we had so much mercy, we just couldn't help but choose Mitch. So this is true of us. And when we get that, that creates deep humility in us. And that humility seeps out in how we treat not just one another, but how we treat people out there in the world as well. Knowing this also creates something else. And this is the best thing. It creates security. Look at it this way. If a wife asks her husband, as many wives are prone to do from time to time, "Why do you love me? Why do you love me?" And if the husband says, "Well, I love you because, man, you are so hot. You're so, oh, man, you're beautiful." Then she'll always wonder if he'll still love her when she gets real old. And maybe she doesn't look quite so beautiful. Or if he says, "Oh, I love you, honey, because you are so smart, so intelligent." She'll always wonder, well, what if he met somebody smarter and more intelligent? Or if she says, "Why do you love me?" And he says, "I love you because, you know what? We have so much fun together. You know, we just love to be active. I love doing stuff with you." Well, she's going to wonder, what about when I get sick, or if I get sick, or if I get paralyzed and he can't do those things with me? Will he still love me? You see what I mean? Let me just say real quick here, footnote for husbands. It's a good thing to tell your wives they're hot and smart, and that you love doing stuff with them. But don't make that the reason you love them. You love her because you love her. You see? You love her because you love her. You see, here's the deal. If you think there's something in you, something about you that drew God to you in the first place, then you're always going to be afraid that if you lose that quality, maybe God will drop you. Maybe God will stop loving you. Maybe God will unchoose you then. But God says, listen, I love you because I love you, and nothing can change that. So that's the first problem. Pride. The attitude that we're better than they are. The second problem is the opposite. It's the problem of fear. The attitude behind this is not, we're better than them. The attitude behind this is, they're bigger than us. That's the attitude. Look down at verse 17, okay, of chapter 7. Moses addresses this problem when he says, if you should say in your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? You shall not be afraid of them. You see the problem? The problem is, listen, I've seen those people. There are giants in there. We don't stand a chance against that. And by the way, do you ever feel like that? Sometimes the battle that God calls us to fight against the world out there and the flesh in here and the devil down there seems so great and so unwinnable that we shrink back and we stop fighting. There's so much out there that can derail us from walking with God. There's so much evil to take on. We wonder, how can I even begin to make a dent in any of it? I can't even deal with my own stuff. God says, you need to deal with that problem by calling a few things to mind. Now, when I say calling to mind, I mean that you have to make a very intentional, concerted effort. What I really mean is you have to learn to preach these truths to yourself. This is how you deal with fear. You preach the truth to yourself. Did you know that you preach to yourself all day long? We all talk to ourselves, don't we, all day long? And what is the content of your sermons? What is the content of what you're telling yourself? Most of us tell ourselves lies all day long about ourselves and about our God. And so what we have to do is we have to learn to call to mind things, to preach to ourselves the truth. And here in this passage, Moses says, listen, I want you to call to mind three things. First of all, call to mind what God has done in the past. Look at the second half of verse 18 and verse 19. Moses says, you shall well remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt, the great trials which your eyes saw, and the signs and the wonders and the mighty hand and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. You see that? He says, remember the past. Remember what God has done for you. Remember all that. Let me ask you a very personal question. Has God fought some battles for you in the past? Has God brought you through some hard times? I mean, if you were able to look into the future and see what you've had to go through, do you think you would have thought you could survive? But now as you look back on those things, do you see, you know what? God carried me every step of the way. And I made it through. And I'm better for it. You know that corny poem, Footsteps? It's a great poem. It expresses a great truth, and it's true. So call to mind what happened in the past. What has God done for me? What's He brought me through? Secondly, you call to mind that He's with you now. Look at verse 21. You shall not dread them, for the Lord your God is in your midst. Not was, is. The great and awesome God. It's wonderful to remember what He did in the past. But you know what? History's fine. I need Him now. And God says, I'm with you now. Remember, Jesus sent His disciples and us into the world, and He said, listen, I'm sending you into the world, and I am with you always, even until the end of the age. Finally, call to mind that the one who fought for you in the past and the great and awesome God who is with you now, He will fight for you in the future. Look at verse 22. The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You will not be able to put an end to them quickly, for the wild beasts would grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will deliver them before you and will throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. God says, listen, I will fight for you and I will deliver you from your enemies. But there's something very curious here. Notice that he also says that I will not do it all at once. I'll only do it little by little. How interesting. And God gives the reason for this. He said, listen, you know, the Canaanites had years of experience, 400 years in that land. The Canaanites had civilized the place. And they had kept the wild animals at bay. And there were all kinds of weird wild animals in that area. Lions and stuff. Remember David and the lion and all that stuff? So God says, listen, if you just went in there and they were gone immediately, that would not be a good thing for you because the wild beasts would overtake the place. You don't know how to handle them yet. And so God says, listen, I'm gonna win this victory for you gradually, little by little. And man, think about how relevant that is for us. I mean, you know what? Sometimes we look out there at the battle and we think, you know what? I'm so tired. God, why don't you just fix it now? Why don't you just end it now? Why don't you just come back now? And you know what? God says, listen, I'm at work little by little. You're going to win the victory, but it's going to be a process. And you know what? We are in the middle of that process. And many of you are in your own life and you're fighting things. And maybe you feel like you're taking two steps back for every step you take forward. But I want you to know that God has said, listen, it won't all happen at once. You won't win this battle all at once. You have to keep plugging away. And trust me, in the end, I win. That's what God says. The battle is mine, so be patient. Let me review. God says, I'm sending you into the world, and you must renounce all that the world stands for. As we say, you have to be in the world, but you don't have to be of the world. Why? Because I've chosen you as my holy people, my treasured possession. And don't get prideful about that because it had nothing to do with how wonderful you are. I loved you because I love you. And don't be afraid. Though the battle seems to go on and on, remember what I've done in the past. Remember that I'm with you now. And remember that I will deliver you in the future. Now this morning, we're going to take communion. And I'm really glad that we're going to take communion today on this particular day that we're looking at Deuteronomy 7 because I want us to prepare for communion in the next few minutes. And what I would like you to do is I really want you to use this message. I want you to use what you have learned this morning. Here at CPC, we take communion on the first Sunday of every month. We invite all those who our believers in Jesus to participate in taking the bread and the cup with us. And one of the reasons that we do this, and one of the things the Bible says that's so important about communion is that we examine ourselves before we take it. And Scripture invites us to go through this process of self-examination when we take communion. And it doesn't do that because you have to be perfect to take communion. The table is set for sinners. That's the whole reason for the table in the first place. And not a single one of us has even made it through the past hour without sinning. So we're all on the same level. But this is a really good time for us to spend time with the Lord, to examine our lives, and really to ask the question, God, how are you speaking to me? God, what are the areas that I have compromised with the world? What are the areas that you want me to make some hard decisions in? And I want you to begin with the self-examination. And then I want you to be sure to remember the grace of God. Remember that the blood of Christ that we celebrate here cleanses us from all sin. And then I want you to take a few minutes in this time. And I also want you to think, okay, God, what is one or two things that I need to do immediately? What do I need to deal with immediately in my life? And I encourage you to prayerfully make some hard decisions today. If the servers will come forward, they'll begin passing out the elements. As I said before, take this as a time of examination. and worship.